When cowards hide and burn the food and fodder, great carles must seek for braver foes. This is known.
It is known,
Jiqui agreed as she poured. Not to me. Dennis had great store by Sir Jorah's council, but to leave Marine untouched was more than she could stomach. She could not forget the children on their posts, the birds tearing at their entrails, their skinny arms pointing up the coast road. Sir Jorah, you say we have no food left. If I march west, how can I feed my freedmen?
You cannot. I'm sorry, Khaleesi. They must feed themselves, or starve. Many and more will die along the march, yes, that will be hard, but there is no way to save them. We need to put this scorched earth well behind us.
Danny had left a trail of corpses behind her when she crossed the Red Waste. It was a sight she never meant to see again.
No, she said, I will not march my people off to die.
My children, there must be some way into the city.
I know a way.
Bron Ben Plum stroked his speckled grey and white beard.
Sewers.
Sewers? What do you mean?
Great brick sewers empty into the Skahazadan, carrying the city's waste. They might be a way in, for a few. That was how I escaped Marine after Scarb lost his head.
Bron Ben made a face.
The smell has never left me. I dream of it some nights.
Sir Jorah looked dubious.
Easier to go out than in, it would seem to me. These sewers empty into the river, you say. That would mean the mouths are right below the walls.
And closed with iron grates, Bron Ben admitted. Though some have rusted through, else I would have drowned in shit. Once inside, it's a long, foul climb in pitch dark through a maze of brick where a man could lose himself forever. The filth is never lower than waist high and can rise above your head from the stains I saw on the walls. There's things down there, too, biggest rats you ever saw. And worse things, nasty.
Dario Naharis laughed.
As nasty as you, when you came crying out, eh? If any man were fool enough to try this, every slaver in Marine would smell them the moment they emerged.
Bron Ben shrugged.
Ergrays asked if there was a way in, so I told her. But Ben Plum isn't going down in them sores again, not for all the gold in the Seven Kingdoms. If there's others want to try it there, they're welcome.
Ego, Jogo, and Grey Worm all tried to speak at once, but Danny raised her hand for silence. These sores do not sound promising. Grey Worm would lead his unsullied down the sores if she commanded it, she knew. Her blood riders would do no less. But none of them were suited to the task. The Dothraki were horsemen, and the strength of the Unsullied was their discipline on the battlefield. Can I send men to die in the dark on such a slender hope?
I must think on this some more. Return to your duties.
Her captains bowed and left her with her handmaids and her dragons. But as Bron Ben was leaving, the Syrian spread his pale white wings and flapped lazily at his head. One of the wings buffeted the cell sword in his face. The white dragon landed awkwardly with one foot on the man's head and one on his shoulder, shrieked, and flew off again.
"He likes you, Ben," said Danny. "And well he might," Brown Ben laughed. "I have me a drop of the dragon blood myself, you know."
"You?"
Danny was startled. Plum was a creature of the Free Companies, an amiable mongrel. He had a broad brown face, with a broken nose, and a head of nappy grey hair, and his Dothraki mother had bequeathed him large brown almond-shaped eyes. He claimed to be part Bravasi, part Summon Islander, part Ibanese, part Kohorik, part Dothraki, part Dornish, and part Westerosi, but this was the first she had heard of Targaryen blood. She gave him a searching look and said, "How could that be?"
"Well," said Bron Ben, "there was some old plum in the Sunset Kingdoms who wed a dragon princess. My grandmama told me the tale. He lived in King Aegon's day."
"Which King Aegon?" Danny asked. 5 Aegons have ruled in Westeros. Her brother's son would have been the 6th, but the usurper's men
had dashed his head against a wall.
Five, were there? Well, that's a confusion. I could not give you a number, my queen. This old Plum was a lord, though. Must have been a famous fellow in his day, the talk of all the land. The thing was, begging your royal pardon, he had himself a cock, 6 foot long.
The three bells in Danny's braid tinkled when she laughed.
You mean inches, I think. Feet, Brown Bent said firmly. If it was inches, who'd want to talk about it now?
Your Grace.
Danny giggled like a little girl.
Did your grandmother claim she'd actually seen this prodigy? That the old crone never did. She was half Ebenese and half Koorik. Never been to Westeros. My grandfather must have told her. Some Dothraki killed him before I was born.
And where did your grandfather's knowledge come from?
One of them tales told at the tit, I'd guess.
Bronn Ben shrugged. That's all I know about Aegon the Unnumbered or old Lord Plum's mighty manhood, I fear. I'd best see to my sons.
Go do that, Danny told him. When Bronn Ben left, she lay back on her cushions. If you were grown, she told Drogon, scratching him between the horns, I'd fly you over the walls and melt that harpy down to slag. But it would be years before her dragons were large enough to ride. And when they are, who shall ride them? The dragon has three heads, but I have only one. She thought of Dario. If ever there was a man who could rape a woman with his eyes, to be sure she was just as guilty. Danny found herself stealing looks at the Tyroshi when her captains came to council, and sometimes at night she remembered the way his gold tooth glittered when he smiled. That, and his eyes. His bright blue eyes. On the road from Yunkai, Dario had brought her a flower or a sprig of some plant every evening when he made his report, to help her learn the land, he said. Wasp willow, dusky roses, wild mint, lady's lace, dagger leaf, broom, prickly ben, harpy's gold. He tried to spare me the sight of the dead children, too. He should not have done that, but he meant it kindly. And Dario Naharis made her laugh, which Ser Jorah never did. Danny tried to imagine what it would be like if she allowed Dario to kiss her, the way Jorah had kissed her on the ship. The thought was exciting and disturbing both at once. It's too great a risk. The Tyroshi sellsword was not a good man. No one needed to tell her that. Under the smiles and jests, he was dangerous, even cruel. Selor and Prendal had woken one morning as his partners. That very night, he'd given her their heads. Khal Drogo could be cruel as well, and there was never a man more dangerous. She had come to love him all the same. Could I love Dario? What would it mean if I took him into my bed? Would that make him one of the heads of the dragon? Ser Jorah would be angry, she knew, but he was the one who said she had to take two husbands. Perhaps I should marry them both and be done with it. But these were foolish thoughts. She had a city to take, and dreaming of kisses and some sellsword's bright blue eyes would not help her breach the walls of Meereen. I am the blood of the dragon, Danny reminded herself. Her thoughts were spinning in circles like a rat chasing its tail. Suddenly she could not stand the close confines of the pavilion another moment. I want to feel the wind on my face and smell the sea. Missandei, she called, have my silver saddled, your own mount as well. The little scribe bowed.
As your grace commands, shall I summon your bloodliners to guard you?
We'll take our stand. I do not mean to leave the camps. She had no enemies among her children, and the Earl Squire would not talk too much, as Belwas would, or look at her like Dario. The grove of burnt olive trees in which she raised her pavilion stood beside the sea, between the Dothraki camp and that of the Unsullied. When the horses had been saddled, Danny and her companions set out along the shoreline away from the city. Even so, she could feel Meereen at her back, mocking her.
When she looked over one shoulder, there it stood, the afternoon sun blazing off the bronze harpy atop the Great Pyramid. Inside Marine, the slavers would soon be reclining in their fringed tokars to feast on lamb and olives, unborn puppies, honeyed dormice, and other such delicacies, whilst outside her children went hungry. A sudden wild anger filled her.
"I will bring you down," she swore.
As they rode past the stakes and pits that surrounded the eunuch encampment, Danny could hear Grey Worm and his sergeants running one company through a series of drills with shield, short sword, and heavy spear. Another company was bathing in the sea, clad only in white linen breech-clouts. The eunuchs were very clean, she had noticed. Some of her sellswords smelled as if they had not washed or changed their clothes since her father lost the Iron Throne, but the unsullied bathed each evening, even if they'd marched all day. When no water was available, they cleansed themselves with sand, the Dothraki way. The eunuchs knelt as she passed, raising clenched fists to their breasts. Danny returned the salute. The tide was coming in, and the surf foamed about the feet of her silver. She could see her ships standing out to sea. Balerion floated nearest, the great cog once known as Sardulian, her sails furled. Further out were the galleys Meraxes and Vagar, formerly Jozo's Prank and Summer Sun. They were Magister Illyrio's ships, in truth, not hers at all, and yet she had given them new names with hardly a thought. Dragon names and more. In old Valyria before the Doom, Balerion, Meraxes, and Vagar had been gods. South of the ordered realm of stakes, pits, drills, and bathing eunuchs lay the encampments of her freedmen, a far noisier and more chaotic place. Danny had armed the former slaves as best she could with weapons from Astapor and Yunkai, and Ser Jorah had organized the fighting men into four strong companies, yet she saw no one drilling here. They passed a driftwood fire, where 100 people had gathered to roast the carcass of a horse. She could smell the meat and hear the fat sizzling as the spit boys turned, but the sight only made her frown. Children ran behind their horses, skipping and laughing. Instead of salutes, voices called to her on every side in a babble of tongues. Some of the freedmen greeted her as mother, whilst others begged for boons or favours. Some prayed for strange gods to bless her, and some asked her to bless them instead. She smiled at them, turning right and left, touching their hands when they raised them, letting those who knelt reach up to touch her stirrup or her leg. Many of the freedmen believed there was good fortune in her touch. "If it helps give them courage, let them touch me," she thought. "There are hard trials yet ahead." Danny had stopped to speak to a pregnant woman who wanted the mother of dragons to name her baby, when someone reached up and grabbed her left wrist. Turning, she glimpsed a tall, ragged man with a shaved head and a sunburnt face. "Not so hard," she started to say, but before she could finish, he'd yanked her bodily from the saddle. The ground came up and knocked the breath out of her as her silver whinnied and backed away. Stunned, Danny rolled to her side and pushed herself onto one elbow. And then she saw the sword.
"There's that treacherous sow," he said. "I knew you'd come to get your feet kissed one day." His head was bald as a melon, his nose red and peeling, but she knew that voice and those pale green eyes. "I'm going to start by cutting off your tits." Danny was dimly aware of Missandei shouting for help. A freedman edged forward, but only a step. One quick slash, and he was on his knees, blood running down his face. Miro wiped his sword on his breeches. "Who's next?"
"I am."
Austin Whitebeard leapt from his horse and stood over her, the salt wind riffling through his snowy hair, both hands on his tall hardwood staff.
"Grandfather," Miro said, "run off before I break your stick in two and buggy you with—"
The old man fainted with one end of the staff, pulled it back, and whipped the other end about faster than Danny would have believed.
The Titan's bastard staggered back into the surf, spitting blood and broken teeth from the ruin of his mouth. Whitebeard put Danny behind him. Miro slashed at his face. The old man jerked back, cat quick. The staff thumped Miro's ribs, sending him reeling. Arston splashed sideways, parried a looping cut, danced away from a second, checked a third mid-swing. The moves were so fast she could hardly follow. Masandi was pulling Danny to her feet when she heard a crack. She thought Arston's staff had snapped, until she saw the jagged bone jutting from Miro's calf. As he fell, the Titan's bastard twisted and lunged, sending his point straight at the old man's chest. Whitebeard swept the blade aside almost contemptuously and smashed the other end of his staff against the big man's temple. Miro went sprawling, blood bubbling from his mouth as the waves washed over him. A moment later, the freedman washed over him too, knives and stones and angry fists rising and falling in a frenzy. Danny turned away, sickened. She was more frightened now than when it had been happening. He would have killed me.
Your Grace, Arston knelt. I am an old man, and shamed. He should never have gotten close enough to seize you. I was lax. I did not know him without his beard and hair.
No more than I did. Danny took a deep breath to stop her shaking. Enemies everywhere. Take me back to my tent, please. By the time Mormont arrived, she was huddled in her lion's pelt, drinking a cup of spice wine. I had a look at the river wall, Ser Jorah started. It's a few feet higher than the others and just as strong, and the Myrneers have a dozen fire hulks tied up beneath the ramparts. She cut him off. You might have warned me that the Titan's bastard had escaped. He frowned.
I saw no need to frighten you, Your Grace. I have offered a reward for his head.
Pay it to Whitebeard. Miro has been with us all the way from Yunkai. He shaved his beard off and lost himself amongst the freedmen, waiting for a chance of vengeance. Arston killed him. Ser Jorah gave the old man a long look.
A squire with a stick slew Miro of Braavos? Is that the way of it?
A stick, Danny confirmed, but no longer a squire. Ser Jorah, it's my wish that Arston be knighted.
No.
The loud refusal was surprise enough. Stranger still, it came from both men at once. Ser Jorah drew his sword.
The Titan's bastard was a nasty piece of work and good at killing. Who are you, old man? A better knight than you, sir,
Arston said coldly.
Knight?
Danny was confused. You said you were a squire.
I was, Your Grace. He dropped to one knee. I esquired for Lord Swan in my youth, and at Magister Illyria's behest I have served Strong Belwas as well. But during the years between, I was a knight in Westeros. I have told you no lies, my queen, yet there are truths I have withheld, and for that, and all my other sins, I can only beg your forgiveness.
What truths have you withheld? Danny did not like this. You will tell me, now. He bowed his head.
At Kaas, when you asked my name, I said I was called Arston. That much was true. Many men had called me by that name, while Belros and I were making our way east to find you. What is not my true name?
She was more confused than angry. He has played me false, just as Jorah warned me. Yet he saved my life just now. Ser Jorah flushed red.
Miro shaved his beard, but you grew one, didn't you? No wonder you look so bloody familiar.
You know him? Danny asked the exiled knight. Lost?
I saw him perhaps a dozen times, from afar most often, standing with his brothers or riding in some tourney, but every man in the Seven Kingdoms knew Barristan the Bold.
He laid the point of his sword against the old man's neck.
Khaleesi, before you kneel Ser Barristan Selmy, Lord Commander of the King's Guard, who betrayed your house to serve the usurper Robert Baratheon.
The old knight did not so much as blink.
The crow calls the raven black, And you speak of betrayal?
Why are you here? Danny demanded of him. If Robert sent you to kill me, why did you save my life?
He served the usurper. He betrayed Rhaegar's memory and abandoned Viserys to live and die in exile. Yet if he wanted me dead, he need only have stood aside.
I want the whole truth now, on your honour as a knight. Are you the usurper's man or mine?
Yours, if you will have me.
Sir Barristan had tears in his eyes.
I took Robert's pardon, I served him in Kingsguard and Council. Served with the Kingslayer and others near his bed, who soiled the white cloak I wore. Nothing will excuse that. I might be serving in King's Landing still, if the vile boy upon the Iron Throne had not cast me aside. It shames me to admit. But when he took the cloak that the White Bull had draped about my shoulders, and sent men to kill me that selfsame day, it was as though he'd ripped a caul off my eyes. That was when I knew I must find my true king and die in his service.
I can grant that wish, Sir Jorah said darkly.
Quiet,
said Danny. I'll hear him out.
It may be that I must die a traitor's death,
Sir Barristan said.
If so, I should not die alone. Before I took Robert's pardon, I fought against him on the Trident. You were on the other side of that battle, Mormont, were you not?
He did not wait for an answer.
Your Grace, I'm sorry I misled you. It was the only way to keep the Lannisters from learning that I had joined you. You are watched, as your brother was. Lord Varys reported every move Viserys made for years. Whilst I sat on the small council, I heard 100 such reports, and since the day you wed Khal Drogo, there has been an informer by your side, selling your secrets, trading whispers to the spider for gold and promises.
He cannot mean. You are mistaken.
Danny looked at Jorah Mormont.
Tell him he's mistaken. There's no informer, Sir Jorah, tell him. We cross the Dothraki Sea together, and the Red Waste. Her heart fluttered like a bird in a trap. Tell him, Jorah. Tell him how he got it wrong.
The others take you, Selmy. Sir Jorah flung his long sword to the carpet. Khaleesi, it was only at the start, before I came to know you, before I came to love. Do not say that word.
She backed away from him. How could you? What did the usurper promise you? Gold? Was it gold?
The Undying had said she would be betrayed twice more, once for gold and once for love.
Tell me what you were promised.
Varys said I might go home.
He bowed his head.
I was going to take you home.
Her dragon sensed her fury. The Syrian roared, and smoke rose grey from his snout. Drogon beat the air with black wings, and Rhaegal twisted his head back and belched flame. I should say the word and burn the two of them. Was there no one she could trust, no one to keep her safe? Are all the knights of Westeros so false as you two? Get out, before my dragons roast you both. What does roast liar smell like? As foul as Bran Ben Sewers? Go!
Sir Barristan rose stiff and slow. For the first time he looked his age.
Where shall we go, Your Grace?
To hell, to serve King Robert.
Danny felt hot tears on her cheeks. Drogon screamed, lashing his tail back and forth.
The others can have you both.
Go away forever, both of you. The next time I see your faces, I'll have your traitors' heads off.
She could not say the words, though. They betrayed me, but they saved me. But they lied.
You go!
My bear, my fierce, strong bear, what will I do without him? And the old man, my brother's friend.
You go! Go!
Where?
And then she knew.
Tyrion. Tyrion dressed himself in darkness, listening to his wife's soft breathing from the bed they shared. "She dreams," he thought, when Sansa murmured something softly, a name perhaps, though it was too faint to say, and turned onto her side. As man and wife they shared a marriage bed, but that was all. Even her tears she hoards to herself. He had expected anguish and anger when he told her of her brother's death, but Sansa's face had remained so still that for a moment he feared she had not understood. It was only later, with a heavy oaken door between them, that he heard her sobbing. Tyrion had considered going to her then, to offer what comfort he could. No, he had to remind himself, she will not look for solace from a Lannister. The most he could do was to shield her from the uglier details of the Red Wedding as they came down from the Twins. Sansa did not need to hear how her brother's body had been hacked and mutilated, he decided, nor how her mother's corpse had been dumped naked into the Green Fork in a savage mockery of House Tully's funeral customs. The last thing the girl needed was more fodder for her nightmares. It was not enough, though. He had wrapped his cloak around her shoulders and sworn to protect her, but that was as cruel a jape as the crown the Freys had placed atop the head of Robb Stark's direwolf after they'd sewn it onto his headless corpse. Sansa knew that as well, the way she looked at him, her stiffness, when she climbed into their bed. When he was with her, never for an instant could he forget who he was or what he was, no more than she did. She still went nightly to the God's Wood to pray, and Tyrion wondered if she were praying for his death. She had lost her home, her place in the world, and everyone she had ever loved or trusted. "Winter is coming," warned the Stark words, and truly it had come for them with a vengeance. "But it is high summer for House Lannister, so why am I so bloody cold?" He pulled on his boots, fastened his cloak with a lion's head brooch, and slipped out into the torch-lit hall. There was this much to be said for his marriage. It had allowed him to escape Maegor's Holdfast. Now that he had a wife and household, his lord father had agreed that more suitable accommodations were required, and Lord Giles had found himself abruptly dispossessed of his spacious apartments atop the kitchen keep. And splendid apartments they were, too, with a large bedchamber, an adequate solar, a bath and dressing room for his wife, and small adjoining chambers for Pod and Sansa's maids. Even Bronn's cell by the stair had a window of sorts. Well, more an arrow slit, but it lets in light. The castle's main kitchen was just across the courtyard, true, but Tyrion found those sounds and smells infinitely preferable to sharing Maegor's with his sister. The less he had to see of Cersei, the happier he was like to be. Tyrion could hear Brella snoring as he passed her cell. Shay complained of that, but it seemed a small enough price to pay. Varys had suggested the woman to him. In former days she had run Lord Renly's household in the city, which had given her a deal of practice at being blind, deaf, and mute. Lighting a taper, he made his way back to the servant's steps and descended. The floors below his own were still, and he heard no footsteps but his own. Down he went, to the ground floor and beyond, to emerge in a gloomy cellar with a vaulted stone ceiling. Much of the castle was connected underground, and the kitchen keep was no exception. Tyrion waddled along a long dark passageway until he found the door he wanted, and pushed through. Within, the dragon skulls were waiting, and so was Shay.
"I thought my lord had forgotten me."
Her dress was draped over a black tooth near as tall as she was, and she stood within the dragon's jaws, nude.
"Balerion," he thought. Or was it Vhagar?
One dragon skull looked much like another. Just the sight of her made him hard.
"Come out of there."
"I won't,"
She smiled her wickedest smile.
"My lord will pluck me from the dragon's jaws, I know."
But when he waddled closer, she leaned forward and blew out the taper.
"She?"
He reached, but she spun and slipped free.
"You have to catch me."
Her voice came from his left.
"My lord must have played monsters and maidens when he was little."
"Are you calling me a monster?"
"No more than I'm a maiden."
She was behind him, her steps soft against the floor.
"You need to catch me, all the same."
He did, finally, but only because she let herself be caught. By the time she slipped into his arms, he was flushed and out of breath from stumbling into dragon skulls. All that was forgotten in an instant when he felt her small breasts pressing against his face in the dark, her stiff little nipples brushing lightly over his lips and the scar where his nose had been. Tyrion pulled her down onto the floor.
"My giant,"
she breathed as he entered her.
"My giants come to save me."
After, as they lay entwined amongst the dragon's skulls, he rested his head against her, inhaling the smooth, clean smell of her hair. "We should go back," he said reluctantly. "It must be near dawn. Sansa will be waking."
"You should give her dream wine," Shay said, "like Lady Tender does with lullies. A cup before she goes to sleep, and we could fuck in bed beside her without her waking." She giggled. "Maybe we should, some night. Would my lord like that?"
Her hand found his shoulder and began to knead the muscles there.
"Your neck is hard as stone. What troubles you?"
Tyrion could not see his fingers in front of his face, but he ticked his woes off on them all the same.
"My wife, my sister, my nephew, my father, the Tyrells,"
he had to move to the other hand,
"Varys, Pycelle, Littlefinger, the Red Viper of Dawn,"
he had come to his last finger,
"the face that stares back out of the water when I wash."
Shay kissed his maimed, scarred nose.
"A brave face, a kind and good face. I wish I could see it now."
All the sweet innocence of the world was in her voice.
"Innocence? Fool, she's a whore. All she knows of men is the bit between their legs. Fool, fool."
"Better you than me," Tyrion sat. "We have a long day before us, both of us.
You shouldn't have blown out that taper. How are we to find our clothing?"
She laughed.
"Maybe we'll have to go naked. And if we're seen, my lord father will hang you."
Hiring Shay as one of Sansa's maids had given him an excuse to be seen talking with her, but Tyrion did not delude himself that they were safe. Varys had warned him.
"I gave Shay a false history, but it was meant for Lollies and Lady Tender. Your sister is of more suspicious mind. If she should ask me what I know..."
"You will tell her some clever lie."
"No, I will tell her that the girl is a common camp follower that you acquired before the battle on the Green Fork and brought to King's Landing against your lord father's express command. I will not lie to the queen."
"You have lied to her before. Shall I tell her that?"
The eunuch sighed.
"That cuts more deeply than a knife, my lord. I have served you loyally, but I must also serve your sister when I can. How long do you think she would let me live if I were of no further use to her whatsoever? I have no fierce sellsword to protect me, no valiant brother to avenge me, only some little birds who whisper in my ear. With those whisperings, I must buy my life anew each day."
"Pardon me if I do not weep for you."
"I shall, but you must pardon me if I do not weep for Shay. I confess I do not understand what there is in her to make a clever man like you act such a fool."
"You might, if you were not a eunuch."
"Is that the way of it? A man may have wits or a bit of meat between his legs, but not both. Varius tittered. Perhaps I should be grateful I was cut then.
The spider was right. Tyrion groped through the dragon-haunted darkness for his small clothes, feeling wretched. The risk he was taking left him tight as a drumhead, and there was guilt as well. "The others can take my guilt," he thought, as he slipped his tunic over his head. "Why should I feel guilty? My wife wants no part of me, and most especially not the part that seems to want her. Perhaps he ought to tell her about Shay. It was not as though he was the first man ever to keep a concubine. Sansa's own oh-so-honourable father had given her a bastard brother. For all he knew, his wife might be thrilled to learn that he was fucking Shay, so long as it spared her his unwelcome touch.
No, I dare not.
Vows or no, his wife could not be trusted. She might be maiden between her legs, but she was hardly innocent of betrayal. She had once spilled her own father's plans to Cersei, and girls her age were not known for keeping secrets. The only safe course was to rid himself of Shay. I might send her to Shataya, Tyrion reflected, reluctantly. In Shataya's brothel, Shay would have all the silks and gems she could wish for, and the gentlest, high-born patrons. It would be a better life by far than the one she had been living when he found her. Or, if she was tired of earning her bread on her back, he might arrange a marriage for her. Bronn, perhaps. The sellsword had never balked at eating off his master's plate, and he was a knight now, a better match than she could elsewise hope for.
Or Sir Talad.
Tyrion had noticed that one gazing wistfully at Shay more than once.
Why not? He's tall, strong, not hard to look upon, every inch the gifted young knight.
Of course, Talad knew Shay only as a pretty young lady's maid in service at the castle. If he wed her and then learned she was a whore.
My lord, where are you? Did the dragons eat you up?
No, here. He groped at a dragon's skull. I have found a shoe, but I believe it's yours.
My lord sounds very solemn. Have I displeased you?
No, he said too curtly. You always please me. And therein is our danger. He might dream of sending her away at times like this, but that never lasted long. Tyrion saw her dimly through the gloom, pulling a woolen sock up a slender leg.
I can see.
A vague light was leaking through the row of long, narrow windows set high in the cellar wall. The skulls of the Targaryen dragons were emerging from the darkness around them, black amidst grey.
Day comes too soon.
A new day, a new year, a new century.
I survive the Green Fork and the Blackwater. I can bloody well survive King Joffrey's wedding.
Shay snatched her dress down off the dragon's tooth and slipped it over her head.
I'll go up first. Brella will want help with the bathwater.
She bent over to give him one last kiss upon the brow.
My giant of Lannister. I love you so.
And I love you as well, sweetling.
A whore she might well be, but she deserved better than what he had to give her.
I will wed her to Sir Talad. He seems a decent man. And tall.
Sansa.
That was such a sweet dream,
Sansa thought drowsily. She had been back in Winterfell, running through the Godswood with her lady. Her father had been there, and her brothers, all of them warm and safe.
If only dreaming could make it so.
She threw back the coverlets.
I must be brave.
Her torments would soon be ended, one way or the other.
If Lady was here, I would not be afraid.
Lady was dead, though. Rob, Bran, Rickon, Arya, her father, her mother, even Septa Mordaine.
All of them dead, but me.
She was alone in the world now. Her lord husband was not beside her, but she was used to that. Tyrion was a bad sleeper, and often rose before the dawn. Usually she found him in the solar, hunched beside a candle, lost in some old scroll or leather-bound book. Sometimes the smell of the morning bread from the ovens took him to the kitchens, and sometimes he would climb up to the roof garden or wander all alone down Traitor's Walk. She threw back the shutters and shivered as goose prickles rose along her arms. There were clouds massing in the eastern sky, pierced by shafts of sunlight.
They looked like two huge castles afloat in the morning sky.
Sansa could see their walls of tumblestone, their mighty keeps and barbicans. Wispy banners swirled from atop their towers and reached for the fast-fading stars. The sun was coming up behind them, and she watched them go from black to grey to a thousand shades of rose and gold and crimson. Soon the wind mushed them together, and there was only one castle where there had been two. She heard the door open as her maids brought the hot water for her bath. They were both new to her service. Tyrion said the women who tended her previously had all been Cersei's spies, just as Sansa had always suspected. "Come see," she told them. "There's a castle in the sky." They came to have a look.
"It's made of gold."
Shay had short, dark hair and bold eyes. She did all that was asked of her, but sometimes she gave Sansa the most insolent looks.
"A castle all of gold. There's a sight I'd like to see."
"A castle, is it?" Brella had to squint. "That tower's tumbling over. Looks like it's all ruins, that is."
Sansa did not want to hear about falling towers and ruined castles. She closed the shutters and said, "We are expected at the Queen's breakfast. Is my lord husband in the solar?"
"No, my lady," said Brella. "I have not seen him."
"Might be he went to see his father," Shay declared. "Might be the king's hand had need of his counsel."
Brella gave a sniff.
"Lady Sansa, you'll be wanting to get into the tub before the water gets too cool."
Sansa let Shay pull her shift over her head and climbed into the big wooden tub. She was tempted to ask for a cup of wine to calm her nerves. The wedding was to be at midday in the great sept of Baelor across the city, and come evenfall the feast would be held in the throne room. 1,000 guests and 77 courses, with singers and jugglers and mummers. But first came breakfast in the Queen's ballroom for the Lannisters and the Tyrell men. The Tyrell women would be breaking their fast with Margaery, and 100-odd knights and lordlings. "They have made me a Lannister," Sansa thought bitterly. Brella sent Shay to fetch more hot water while she washed Sansa's back.
"You're trembling, my lady."
"The water is not hot enough," Sansa lied. Her maids were dressing her when Tyrion appeared, Podrick Payne in tow.
"You look lovely, Sansa."
He turned to his squire.
"Pod, be so good as to pour me a cup of wine."
"There will be wine at breakfast, my lord," Sansa said. "There's wine here. You don't expect me to face my sister sober, surely?"
"It's a new century, my lady. The 300th year since Aegon's conquest."
The dwarf took a cup of bread from Podrick and raised it high.
"To Aegon! What a fortunate fellow! Two sisters, two wives, and three big dragons. What more could a man ask for?"
He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. The imp's clothing was soiled and unkempt, Sansa noticed. It looked as though he'd slept in it.
"Will you be changing into fresh garb, my lord? Your new doublet is very handsome."
"The doublet is handsome, yes."
Tyrion put the cup aside.
"Come, Pod, let us see if we can find some garments to make me look less dwarfish. I would not want to shame my lady wife."
When the imp returned a short time later, he was presentable enough, and even a little taller. Podrick Payne had changed as well, and looked almost a proper squire for once, although a rather large red pimple in the fold beside his nose spoilt the effect of his splendid purple, white, and gold raiment. He is such a timid boy. Sansa had been wary of Tyrion Squire at first. He was a Payne, cousin to Sir Ilyan Payne, who had taken her father's head off. However, she had soon come to realize that Pod was as frightened of her as she was of his cousin. Whenever she spoke to him, he turned the most alarming shade of red. "Are purple, gold, and white the colors of House Payne, Podrick?" she asked him politely.
"No. I mean, yes," he blushed. "The colors, our arms are purple and white checky, my lady, with gold coins in the checks. Purple and white, both."
He studied her feet. "There's a tale behind those coins," said Tyrion. "No doubt Pod will confide it to your toes one day. Just now we are expected at the Queen's ballroom, however. Shall we?" Sansa was tempted to beg off. I could tell him that my tummy was upset, or that my moon's blood had come. She wanted nothing more than to crawl back in bed and pull the drapes. I must be brave, like Rub, she told herself, as she took her lord husband stiffly by the arm. In the Queen's ballroom they broke their fast on honey cakes baked with blackberries and nuts, gammon steaks, bacon, fingerfish crisp in breadcrumbs, autumn pears, and a Dornish dish of onions, cheese, and chopped eggs cooked up with fiery peppers. "Nothing like our tea at breakfast to whet one's appetite for the 77-course feast to follow," Tyrion commented as their plates were filled. There were flagons of milk and flagons of mead, and flagons of a light sweet golden wine to wash it down. Musicians strolled among the tables, piping and fluting and fiddling, while Sodontus galloped about on his broomstick horse and Moonboy made farting sounds with his cheeks and sang rude songs about the guests. Tyrion scarce touched his food, Sansa noticed, though he drank several cups of the wine. For herself she tried a little of the Dornish eggs, but the peppers burned her mouth. Otherwise she only nibbled at the fruit and fish and honey cakes. Every time Joffrey looked at her, her tummy got so fluttery that she felt as though she'd swallowed a bat. When the food had been cleared away, the Queen solemnly presented Joff with the wife's cloak that he would drape over Margaery's shoulders. "It is the cloak I donned when Robert took me for his queen, the same cloak my mother Lady Joanna wore when wed to my lord father." Sansa thought it looked threadbare, if truth be told, but perhaps because it was so used. Then it was time for gifts. It was traditional in the Reach to give presents to bride and groom on the morning of their wedding. On the morrow they would receive more presents as a couple, but today's tokens were for their separate persons. From Jalabar Zoe, Joffrey received a great bow of golden wood and quiver of long arrows fletched with green and scarlet feathers. From Lady Tanda a pair of supple riding boots, from Sir Kevin a magnificent red leather jousting saddle, a red gold brooch wrought in the shape of a scorpion from the Dornishman Prince Oberon, silver spurs from Sir Adam Marbrant, a red silk tawny pavilion from Lord Mathis Rowan. Lord Paxter Red Wine brought forth a beautiful wooden model of the war galley of 200 oars being built even now on the Arbor. "If it please your grace, she would be called King Joffrey's Valor," he said, and Joffrey allowed that he was very pleased indeed. "I will make it my flagship when I sail to Dragonstone to kill my traitor uncle Stannis," he said. "He plays the gracious king today." Joffrey could be gallant when it suited him, Sansa knew, but it seemed to suit him less and less. Indeed, all his courtesy vanished at once when Tyrion presented him with their own gift, a huge old book called Lives of Four Kings, bound in leather and gorgeously illuminated. The king leafed through it with no interest. "And what is this, uncle?"
"A book."
Sansa wondered if Joffrey moved those fat, wormy lips of his when he read. "The Grand Maester Case History of the Reigns of Daeron the Young Dragon, Baelor the Blessed, Aegon the Unworthy, and Daeron the Good," her small husband answered. "A book every king should read, Your Grace," said Sir Kevin. "My father had no time for books." Joffrey shoved the term across the table. "If you read less, Uncle Imp, perhaps Lady Sansa would have a baby in her belly by now." He laughed, and when the king laughs, the court laughs with him. "Don't be sad, Sansa. Once I've gotten Queen Marjorie with child, I'll visit your bedchamber and show my little uncle how it's done." Sansa reddened. She glanced nervously at Tyrion, afraid of what he might say. This could turn as nasty as the bedding had at their own feast. But for once the dwarf filled his mouth with wine instead of words. Lord Mace Tyrell came forward to present his gift, a golden chalice 3 feet tall, with 2 ornate curved handles and 7 faces glittering with gemstones.
7 faces for your grace's 7 kingdoms, the bride's father explained.
He showed them how each face bore the sigil of one of the great houses. Ruby lion, emerald rose, onyx stag, silver trout, blue jade falcon, opal sun, and pearl direwolf.
"A splendid cup," said Joffrey, "but we'll need to chop the wolf off and put a squid in its place, I think."
Sansa pretended that she had not heard.
"Marjorie and I shall drink deep at the feast, good father."
Joffrey lifted the chalice above his head for everyone to admire.
"The damn thing's as tall as I am," Tyrion muttered in a low voice. "Half a chalice, and Joff will be falling down drunk."
"Good," she thought. "Perhaps he'll break his neck." Lord Tywin waited until last to present the king with his own gift, a longsword. Its scabbard was made of cherry wood, gold, and oiled red leather, studded with golden lions' heads. The lions had ruby eyes, she saw. The ballroom fell silent as Joffrey unsheathed the blade and thrust the sword above his head. Red and black ripples in the steel shimmered in the morning light.
"Magnificent," declared Mathis Rowan.
"A sword to sing of, sire," said Lord Redwine.
"A king's sword," said Sir Kevin Lannister.
King Joffrey looked as if he wanted to kill someone right then and there, he was so excited. He slashed at the air and laughed.
"A great sword must have a great name, my lords. What shall they call it?"
Sansa remembered Lion's Tooth, the sword Arya had flung into the trident, and Heart Eater, the one he'd made her kiss before the battle. She wondered if he'd want Marjorie to kiss this one. The guests were shouting out names for the new blade. Joffrey dismissed a dozen before he heard one he liked.
"Widow's Wail," he cried. "Yes, it shall make many a widow, too."
He slashed again.
"And when I face my uncle Stannis, it will break his magic sword clean in two."
Joff tried a down cut, forcing Sir Balon Swan to take a hasty step backward. Laughter rang through the hall at the look on Sir Balon's face.
"Have a care, Your Grace,"
Sir Adam Marbrunt warned the king.
"Valyrian steel is perilously sharp."
"I remember."
Joffrey brought Widow's Wail down in a savage two-handed slice onto the book that Tyrion had given him. The heavy leather cover parted at a stroke.
"Sharp, I tell you. I am no stranger to Valyrian steel."
It took him half a dozen further cuts to hack the thick tome apart, and the boy was breathless by the time he was done. Sansa could feel her husband struggling with his fury as Sir Osmond Kettleback shouted,
"I pray you, never turn that wicked edge on me, sire. See that you never give me cause, sir."
Joffrey flicked a chunk of Lives of Four Kings off the table at sword point, then slid Widow's Wail back into its scabbard.
Your Grace, Sir Garland Tyrell said, perhaps you did not know, in all of Westeros there were but 4 copies of that book illuminated in Caith's own hand.
Now there are 3.
Joffrey undid his old sword belt to don his new one.
You and Lady Sansa owe me a better present, Uncle Imp. This one is all chopped to pieces.
Tyrion was staring at his nephew with his mismatched eyes.
Perhaps a knife, sire, to match your sword. A dagger of the same fine Valyrian steel, with a dragonbone hilt, say.
Joffrey gave him a sharp look.
You? Yes. A dagger to match my sword. Good.
He nodded.
A gold hilt with rubies in it. Dragonbone is too plain.
As you wish, Your Grace. Tyrion drank another cup of wine. He might have been all alone in Isola for all the attention he paid Sansa, but when the time came to leave for the wedding, he took her by the hand. As they were crossing the yard, Prince Oberyn of Dorne fell in beside them, his black-haired paramour on his arm. Sansa glanced at the woman curiously. She was base-born and unwed, and had borne 2 bastard daughters for the prince. But she did not fear to look even the queen in the eye. She had told her that this Ilaria worshipped some Lycian love goddess.
She was almost a whore when he found her, milady, her maid confided, and now she's near a princess.
Sansa had never been this close to the Dornish woman before.
She's not truly beautiful, she thought, but something about her draws the eye. I once had the great good fortune to see the Citadel's copy of Lives of 4 Kings, Prince Oberyn was telling her lord husband. The illuminations were wondrous to behold, but Caith was too kind by half to King Viserys.
Tyrion gave him a sharp look.
Too kind? He scans Viserys shamefully, in my view. It should have been Lives of 5 Kings.
The prince laughed.
Viserys hardly reigned a fortnight.
He reigned more than a year, said Tyrion. Oberyn gave a shrug.
A year or a fortnight, what does it matter? He poisoned his own nephew to gain the throne, and then did nothing once he had it.
Baelor starved himself to death fasting, said Tyrion. His uncle served him loyally as hand, as he had served the young dragon before him.
Viserys might have only reigned a year, but he ruled for 15, while Daeron warred and Baelor prayed.
He made a sour face.
And if he did remove his nephew, can you blame him? Someone had to save the realm from Baelor's follies.
Sansa was shocked.
But Baelor the Blessed was a great king. He walked the Bone Way barefoot to make peace with Dorne, and rescued the Dragon Knight from a snake pit. The vipers refused to strike him because he was so pure and holy.
Prince Oberyn smiled.
If you were a viper, my lady, would you want to bite a bloodless stick like Baelor the Blessed? I'd sooner save my fangs for someone juicier. My prince is playing with you, Lady Sansa, said the woman Ilaria Sand. The Septons and singers like to say that the snakes did not bite Baelor, but the truth is very different. He was bitten 50 times, and should have died from it.
If he had, Viserys would have reigned 12 years, said Tyrion, and the 7 kingdoms might have been better served. Some believe Baelor was deranged by all that vellum.
Yes, said Prince Oberyn, but I have seen no snakes in this red keep of yours. So how do you account for Joffrey?
I prefer not to. Tyrion inclined his head stiffly. If you will excuse us, our litter awaits. The dwarf helped Sansa up inside and clambered awkwardly after her. Close the curtains, my lady, if you'll be so good.
Must we, my lord?
Sansa did not want to be shut behind the curtains. The day is so lovely.
The good people of King's Landing are like to throw dung at the litter if they see me inside it. Do us both a kindness, my lady. Close the curtains.
She did as he bid her. They sat for a time,
as the air grew warm and stuffy around them. "I was sorry about your book, my lord," she made